From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, being a labor lawyer in an era when the labor movement has lost its power. We talk with Tom Gagin, author of the new memoir, Which Side Are You On? Trying to Be for Labor When It's Flat on Its Back. He's represented workers in disputes with management, but he's also represented dissident workers in their disputes with corrupt union leaders. Also today, talking back to bad movies with Joel Hodgson and Mike Nelson of Cable TV's Mystery Science Theater 3000. And Ken Tucker reviews Willie Nelson's new album, The IRS Tapes. It's the record he made to pay off the money he owes to the IRS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Witnesses in Moscow say that as many as three people have been killed and 10 wounded in a clash with a Soviet armored vehicle. That incident took place near the Russian Parliament building, where demonstrators reportedly trapped the vehicle beneath an underpass. A Reuters photographer reports seeing three bodies on the pavement. News of the killings came along with reports that Soviet tanks were advancing on the Russian Parliament building, where President Boris Yeltsin is leading the opposition. NPR's Ann Cooper describes Yeltsin's day.
Yeltsin only made one public appearance today. He spoke at a huge rally outside the Russian Parliament building. Tonight, one Russian government official declined to say where Yeltsin was. He had been in the Russian Parliament building. He is continuing to issue orders, although his orders are being canceled, or at least on paper canceled, by the committee that says it's now ruling the Soviet Union. That is the Committee for State Emergency. Yeltsin's most recent order says that he is taking responsibility as commander-in-chief for all of the armed forces located on the territory of Russia. He's essentially asking all of these troops that have been moved into Moscow and other cities to now obey his commands and not those of the Committee for State Emergency.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. There were rumors all day today that the 8-member emergency committee that engineered the coup against President Gorbachev was breaking up. A top member of the Communist Party's Politburo denied that Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov and KGB chief Vladimir Kruchkov had resigned. Central Soviet Television, which is controlled by the emergency committee, reported that Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov was very ill with high blood pressure. The report said that Pavlov had been confined to bed. After swearing in his new ambassador to the Soviet Union, Robert Strauss, President Bush announced he's sending his envoy to Moscow immediately. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president repeated his charge that the current Soviet government is unconstitutional and that there will not be normal relations between it and the United States. Nevertheless, Mr. Bush says he is sending Strauss to Moscow.
So I'm asking him to go over there, get the lay of the land, establish what will be strong leadership, the embassy. We've got a good team in place, but this man is in charge of this important mission.
Mr. Bush says Ambassador Strauss will only stay a few days and will return to report back to him. The president also says Strauss will not present his credentials to the current Soviet government. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 16 points to close at 2,913.63. Advances led declines by a margin of almost 2-1. This is NPR News. The Parliament of the Baltic Republic of Estonia has declared immediate full independence from the Soviet Union. A parliamentary spokeswoman said the unanimous vote was taken inside the barricaded parliament building in Tallinn. The Estonian news agency reported that lawmakers said they made the declaration because they don't believe they can negotiate independence with the hardliners in the Kremlin. Soviet troops seized control of radio and television stations and blocked harbors in the Baltics after the announcement of yesterday's coup. Estonian leaders have claimed that Soviet troops in Estonia have indicated they will not use force if they're ordered to do so by the new Soviet leadership. In the wake of the political upheaval in the Soviet Union, as many as 6 Soviets plan to seek political asylum in Seattle. Carol Levinson reports they decided not to return to a Soviet ship that left Seattle last night.
26-year-old Sasuna Kopian was the cook aboard the ship, which docked in Seattle as part of a goodwill visit to the United States. He's retained a lawyer who says Kopian will file for political asylum with immigration authorities in Seattle today. Kopian, who is from Armenia, says he participated in the independence movement in his republic. Through a translator, he says he fears persecution if he returns home.
All the KGB, KGB guys knew him before, and now they would have an opportunity just to catch him, and he doesn't know what's going to happen, what would happen to him if he would go back. I mean, there are a lot of possibilities. He might get killed or something, or they would imprison him.
Kopian's lawyer says he's also been contacted by five other Soviets who stayed behind after the ship they were on left Seattle. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
New York developer Peter Calico filed for personal bankruptcy today. Calico is best known as the owner of the New York Post newspaper, but he's also the developer of some of the city's biggest apartment and commercial properties. Calico's bankruptcy filing listed his net worth as almost $500 million. I'm Corey Flintoff in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Thomas Gagin, is a labor lawyer. What even he admits is a dying breed. In the 1980s, we saw Solidarity transform Poland's government, while in America, we watched manufacturing go down the drain, and with it, the labor movement. Even liberals and progressives don't seem to need the labor movement anymore, Gagin says. He's written a new book that's part memoir, part labor history, called Which Side Are You On? Trying to be for labor when it's flat on its back. In last week's New York Times book review, it was described as unparalleled in the literature of American labor. Gagin has represented teamsters, steelworkers, nurses, and carpenters. He's also written for the New Republic. He writes in his book that he never mentions at parties what kind of work he does, because he thinks most people have a stereotyped image of labor lawyers.
The popular image, I think, is cigar-chomping, 50-ish, balding person who maybe hangs out with union goons and thugs and so forth. And since I am thin and drink Perrier water and jog a lot and eat pasta and work out at health clubs and pass as a yuppie, I think some people don't know me well do a double take when they hear that I'm a labor lawyer. And I think some are surprised that there's still a labor movement left.
Now, I know two people who were union organizers in the 30s and 40s, and they don't like to tell people about that now. Their feeling is people don't understand what unions meant because unions don't have the same meaning anymore. I'd like to get your reaction to that.
Well, I think that's sad. Even those people have lost interest in it. The ironic thing is that the labor movement remains as important as ever. We're simply in a historical era where it has disappeared. It was once 34% of the private sector workforce. Now it's down to 12% of the private sector workforce. So no wonder people don't own up to it. And would you own up to being part of an organization that is headed by people who are, at best, sort of faceless and rather bureaucratic?
Your book is called Which Side Are You On? And even within labor, there are several sides.
Yes.
For instance, rank and file versus the bureaucracy within the union. So even within the union, there's different sides that you can be on. Do you ever feel almost alienated from the rank and file, even though you're representing them, because you're working in this office building that kind of represents the bureaucracy while the people in the union are in the factory or the mines or whatever?
Sure. When I was at the mine workers in Washington, D.C., I had a sense of living in John L. Lewis's old private club. While out there in the coal fields, the rank and file were striking and going on wildcat strikes that we at the International Union couldn't control. And it seems like the rank and file had their own sense, the mine worker rank and file then, had their own sense of what the union should be like, and we had our own sense, we the staff. That's partly because of labor laws. The union bureaucracy is made responsible for the actions of the rank and file. We sometimes want them to behave, and they don't behave. And yet, perhaps they have a purer sense of what the union is about than we, who are the lawyers and the economists and the researchers.
How so?
Well, in the case of the mine workers, for example, the labor laws had just broken down. The grievances had become backlogged horribly, and the membership began going out on wildcat strikes, one right after another. In 1975 and 1976, at times there were these nationwide wildcat strikes. Meanwhile, the young lawyers and economists and researchers back in Washington, D.C. are trying to go before the federal judge and say, "Judge, we're trying to stop these. We want these people to behave. We don't want to risk contempt of court." You know, we the staff are terrified in Washington, D.C. And sometimes we would think, "Well, my God, what are they doing out there?" And yet, by doing this, by openly you know, walking out, they were calling attention to their problems, and it did end up with some better form of mediation of grievances. They did resolve with these wildcats the problems of huge backlogs of grievances and so forth. We, the staff, the professionals, quote unquote, are responsible to the courts, we're responsible to the federal agencies, we're responsible to act in a certain way under federal labor law, and you know, do naturally develop a different agenda.
So, you know, even the labor lawyers can, even with the best of intentions, get down in bureaucracy that the workers will sometimes defy in something like a wildcat strike, something
well,
you
worst,
can't afford to do.
Yes. And the worst of it is internal union democracy. That's the classic problem today. The lawyers work for the top union officers who, in turn, do whatever they can to keep themselves in office indefinitely. And the lawyers and the economists and the other bureaucrats are part of that effort. And it's very tragic. It's one of the tragedies of modern American labor.
Now, how do you make sure that you're, as a labor lawyer, not just representing the union bureaucracy whose job is to keep themselves in power, but that you're actually representing the interests of the men and women who work?
Oh, it's probably an insoluble dilemma. I no longer represent that many unions. I'm a curiosity in the labor lawyer group in that I do represent some unions. I also sue unions. I've represented groups of Teamster dissidents and steelworker union dissidents and so forth over the years. This is verboten. This is the unforgivable sin. And it's I know that there are many decent, wonderful people who've given their lives to be labor lawyers who get caught up representing a specific group of officers and become part of their organization and are responsible to them. You know, it takes a lot of idealism to become a labor lawyer, and one of the tragedies is that a lot of these people end up getting involved for idealistic reasons and then being prisoners of a bureaucracy. And they hate it deep down, I think. Many of them won't express it, and some of them don't feel it at all, but I think there are others who do hate it. The solution is not for individual acts of heroism. It's very, very simple solution, and that's just to have Congress pass a law requiring unions to be democratic and having outside agencies count the vote and allowing the rank and files in these unions to directly elect their officers.
Now, you're right, when people say, why can't labor organize like it did in the 1930s, that there's a simple answer for that. Everything labor did in the 1930s is illegal today. What
yes.
are some examples of what you mean there?
The mass picketing, the secondary boycott strikes, which were enormously effective, the even the sit-ins that that occurred back then, the fact is that it's not the only problem, but labor laws are set up in a very curious way. If the employer violates labor law, the employee has the right to go to the NLRB and complain about his unjust discharge. And this litigation takes 3-4 years or so, can go up to the Court of Appeals and back. And at the end of it, the employee is entitled to back pay minus anything he's earned. And by then, the organizing drive is over, the union has been smashed, and it all becomes irrelevant. When unions violate labor laws, it's quite a different story. The NLRB is compelled by federal law to go into federal court immediately to seek injunctions against federal boycotts. The unions, secondary boycotts, the union can be liable in treble damages. There are contempt fines that immediately begin adding up. The UMW, the United Mine Workers, where I worked, was always on the verge of bankruptcy. There's kind of a labor lawyer hall of fame in the United Mine Workers, a group of lawyers who over the decades have saved the union at the last minute from total financial bankruptcy. It's a scary and frightening situation to be in. Employers face the sort of legal penalties, I suppose, that one faces from jaywalking for breaking federal labor laws.
I have a friend who was trying to unionize with a group of other people, and everybody who was going to vote in this election of whether they should unionize or not was called in by the employer beforehand and, you know, given this rap about how it would really be bad for the organization and so on. Would that have been legal a few years ago?
Well, it really was not legal until Taft-Hartley. It was regarded as intimidation. And it's so hard to explain quickly how different our legal system is from those of other industrial countries. Canada is the most obvious example because it's so similar to ours. But in Canada, the union simply hands out authorization cards, and when 55% sign up, there's a union. The employer has to bargain. Here it's the beginning of this long Bleak House sort of litigation with a whole range of threats that are now generally allowed by employers to make. And the threats that the employers are allowed to make have to be coupled with the threats that are illegal, which employers are also allowed to make, even though they're nominally illegal, because there's no sanctions against them.
You've written about what a bad period this is to use the strike as a weapon, and you point out that strikers are really afraid they'll lose their job in 24 hours. What's changed for the strike? Yeah,
there are two theories about this. The conventional theory is PATCO. Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, and all the other employers followed suit. I think that's way too simplistic. I think what Reagan did in PATCO was simply, like jousting at a house of cards. The labor movement was already nearly dead in 1980, and Reagan simply delivered the news. Because for years and years and years and years, unions had been unable to organize. There isn't any, by the time of PATCO, there wasn't any union movement left. And what was more damaging about the PATCO thing, PATCO couldn't have been pulled off when 33 or 34% of the private sector workforce was unionized. It couldn't have happened. Or it couldn't have happened in the same way. Now we live in a time where A, very few people are in unions, and B, hardly any of them are ever going to get into them anyway. And Americans just don't have a stake in labor anymore. So naturally they're hostile to the few of their fellow citizens who are in the labor movement.
So getting back to why the strike isn't a very potent tool anymore.
Well, my view is that the strike really depends upon the culture, the effectiveness of the strike. If, for example, the Daily News strike worked in New York, partly because New York is the last union town in America, there are a lot of people in New York who are in unions, and there were a lot who had a stake in seeing that strike succeed. In the country at large, we don't have a union membership out there anymore. And it is a culture that has a lot of, that's ripe for scabbing now. People are never going to, ratchet their way up to union level jobs anymore. So why not go in and replace the workers who have been fired? The national pro football strike. I remember seeing scabs on TV who were saying, "Gee, we wish these players well, but this is America." But it wasn't America in America in 1940s and 1950s. The country has changed, and the way it's changed is we don't have a union culture here anymore the way we did 30, 40 years ago. That's why PATCO was successful.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with labor lawyer Tom Gagin, and he's written a new memoir about the labor movement and about his work within it. It's called Which Side Are You On? Trying to Be for Labor When It's Flat on Its Back. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I guess, is labor lawyer Tom Gagin, who has also written for The New Republic. You know, some people think that the unions kind of killed themselves by demanding wages that companies couldn't afford and by allowing levels of corruption that were, you know, just really bad for the health of the union.
Well, there's a lot of merit in the second point. I don't think there's much merit in the first. Unions have mostly been in very capital-intensive industries in which labor costs are very, very small part of the product that goes out the door. It could be, you know, 10%, less than 10%. So, you know, as one, you raise, even you double wages, sometimes you're adding only pennies to the cost of the final product. Although one could argue that the burden of providing things that the government ought to provide itself, like health insurance, really has made some of our products less competitive. But I do think there's merit in the second observation, which is that
about corruption.
Well, there has been corruption. I've certainly been representing dissident groups in various unions, Teamsters, steelworkers. The book that I've written is certainly not very kind to the top union leadership, which has been involved in some specific cases in massive corruption, the Teamsters in particular. Other unions, it's more complicated. There's kind of a moral corruption that sets in. You have cases like this fellow, the sheet metal workers president, whose father was the president of the sheet metals worker, I'm sure. His son is going to be the next president of the sheet metal workers union in all probability, if he can arrange it. These places are egregiously oligarchic, and there is no functioning democracy in them. And as a result, what's going to happen? Well, they're going to become corrupt. It's inherent in the whole process.
When you say that there's no functioning democracy within the unions, you mean the rank and file don't get to vote for the leadership?
That's right. They don't have the right to elect their top officers. And often the elections are corrupt because you have the incumbents counting the ballots, and it's very difficult to provide any kind of effective observer system. And I know many people say, well, you know, the unions aren't corrupt, and many unions operate honestly. But, you know, there are cases of ballot stuffing even in the progressive honest unions, like the United Auto Workers in some cases, have been found guilty of that. It's very difficult to ask people they're not going back into private law firms that they lose these offices. I mean, they're headed down to the shop floor. And to operate the whole thing under the honor system is asking an awful lot of human nature. Even in the honest progressive unions, to say nothing about the more corrupt ones, and the membership senses that.
You really think that unions' health could be vastly improved if every union was democratic? You know, the rank and file had the vote, and also if the votes were counted by an impartial party. Why do you think that would be enough to really change unions and to end corruption?
Well, it's not enough, but it would be a start. And it's the only thing that's in the control of the unions right now. Number one, Congress, or we can never get a reform of the Wagner Act that would put real sanctions on employers for firing workers and would shut down these union-busting campaigns. It's just not going to happen with a Republican administration. Also, the unions can't change industrial policy, which has been oriented for decades in favor of the financial sector at the expense of the industrial sector. So what can unions do, or what can the progressive left do at the moment? It's to change themselves. There might be a chance, perhaps, although I sense strong Republican opposition to this, to pass a bill that would provide for democratic rank-and-file elections, as are now going on in the Teamsters Union under a special court order. If you look at what's happening in the Teamsters right now, the Democratic Convention, the real battle for in this rank-and-file vote that is going to take place in December between Kerry and Durham and Walter Shea, it's a remarkable development in that union, which has supposedly been this corrupt, closed, oligarchic place. That model could be applied to every union. So that would be my hope for it. And I think that my real hope is that you begin this process by electing leaders who are at least presentable, articulate, and maybe in a couple of cases charismatic. Of the 33 AFL-CIO presidents right now, the one that everyone unanimously picks as the most articulate, attractive labor leader is Rich Trumka of the United Mine Workers. And he's the only one who comes out of a union with a strong democratic tradition where the rank and file do have the right to vote and where there are other procedures that encourage democracy.
You know, most people think of unions as being about solidarity. And your book about unions is really, in a lot of ways, about alienation. Because, you know, you're alienated from a lot of your former college friends because they don't understand unions. A lot of people in America don't understand unions anymore. But you're even alienated within the unions because you're perceived as being different from the workers, since you're a lawyer. You're often suing the union leadership itself, representing dissident workers. So can you just talk about that a little bit, about feeling alienated within a movement that's supposed to be about solidarity?
Well, except it's the alienated people in this movement right now who often have the strongest sense of solidarity with each other. And there are, I'm in it for the moments of solidarity. Some of them I try to describe in the book. I've been to union halls, and you see these 40, 50-year-old guys holding hands with each other and singing Solidarity Forever, and you have to see it two or three times before you believe you saw it once. It does happen. There are things like, you know, these banquets where people feed you CBS, as it's called in South Chicago, chicken, beef, and sausage, and you see people gathering around, and it's more just an association for economic interests. There's some real community here, and that's what puts gas in your tank for a couple of months. That's the real labor movement. There is one in this country. It's sort of an exile, but it's in almost every union, that's the part that attracts me.
Labor lawyer Thomas Gagan. His new book is called Which Side Are You On? Trying to Be for Labor When It's Flat on Its Back. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pity poor Joel, trapped up in outer space with just some robots to keep him company, forced to watch horrible movies. That's the premise of the quirky cable comedy show Mystery Science Theater 3000. Coming up, we talk with the show's creator and host, Joel Hodgson, and the head writer, Mike Nelson. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Willie Nelson's new album, the album he made to help him pay off what he owes the IRS. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the latest book in the ongoing debate over whether students should be required to read a set curriculum of great books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to reports from Moscow, Soviet soldiers shot and killed three people after protesters of the Soviet coup trapped a military vehicle underneath an underpass. There have been unconfirmed reports of additional deaths and injuries. This occurred shortly after midnight Moscow time, when gunfire was heard near the Russian Parliament building. Boris Yeltsin and thousands of supporters have barricaded themselves inside and near the government building. Meanwhile, in Latvia, there are reports that the Latvian prime minister has been arrested after Soviet troops surrounded the government building in the Latvian capital. On a day of fast developments in Moscow, there have been reports of up to three members of the ruling coup having stepped down. These reports have not been confirmed, and as NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow, it's unclear what this might mean.
One of the resignations was officially reported on Vremya, the television news program, tonight. That was Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov, who is said to have very high blood pressure and therefore had to resign and be replaced by one of his deputies. It seemed a very odd coincidence coming just one day after the Committee for State Emergency said that Mikhail Gorbachev had also resigned for health reasons. The other resignations are not confirmed. One of them is Defense Minister Yazov. The other is the KGB chief, Kruchkov. It's hard to know exactly what these resignations mean, if all of them are true. One possibility, one scenario, is that these men are now making way for a more hardline leadership. Another is that the committee, faced with this very heavy resistance in Moscow and in many other parts of the Soviet Union, is collapsing.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. Secretary of State James Baker leaves tonight for Brussels to attend a meeting of NATO foreign ministers concerning the government coup in Moscow. Barry Schwide has more.
Unity is what Baker seeks, and shunning the ruling coalition as long as it's diplomatically possible. But already, there are rumblings within the alliance of a need to establish contact with the coalition in an effort to maintain the conciliatory policies undertaken by Mikhail Gorbachev. The Bush administration's strategy is to deny the coalition diplomatic recognition, hoping that will restore the fallen leader to power. Under Gorbachev, the Soviets completed arms control agreements with the West that require far deeper cuts in Soviet strength than in NATO's. Those agreements are now on hold, even though the new Soviet leadership said it would honor the commitments undertaken by Gorbachev. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 15 points to close at 2,913.68. This is NPR News. At Cape Canaveral, an out-of-control rocket was destroyed shortly after liftoff this morning. The rocket was carrying secret so-called Star Wars experiments and veered sharply off course after it was launched. Officials say that no one was injured when most of the rocket debris came down in a remote area of an Air Force base. Officials in Germany are keeping a watchful eye on 270,000 Soviet troops still stationed in that country. Soviet Army officials in Berlin have promised that the pullout of their units will continue as scheduled, but concern is mounting in Germany that the change of governments in Moscow could slow the pullout. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Berlin.
Under an agreement reached last year, the Soviet Union is to pull all its soldiers out of Germany by 1994 in exchange for massive German economic aid. So far, officials here say the withdrawal is on schedule. But the group now in power in Moscow includes critics of the withdrawal agreement, so Germans are worried that the Soviet government might be less cooperative from here on. Since the troop pullout began, there's been widespread unrest among Soviet soldiers in Germany. Many don't want to return to the Soviet Union because of housing and employment shortages there. The Interior Minister for the German state of Mecklenburg-Pomerania said today that new political officers were recently appointed at nearby Soviet army bases and that they've stepped up pro-Soviet propaganda among their soldiers in an effort to reduce the rate of desertions. According to German authorities, at least 200 Soviet soldiers have filed for political asylum here in the past year. I'm Tom Gelton in Berlin.
Walter Leroy Moody, convicted in the mail bomb deaths of a federal judge and a civil rights attorney, has been given a prison term of 7 life sentences plus 400 years. The 58-year-old Georgia man was convicted in June on all charges in a 71-count federal indictment. His trial was moved to St. Paul in part because of pretrial publicity. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Willie Nelson helped organize a series of farm aid concerts in the 1980s, but recently Nelson found himself in a position of needing some financial help. He owes millions of dollars in back taxes. The profits of Willie Nelson's new album, sold by mail order, are going toward paying off his debt. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
A past that's sprinkled with the blues, a few old dreams that I can't use. Who'll buy my memories of things that used to be?
The idea sounds like a joke, and the result could easily have been an embarrassment. But Willie Nelson's Who'll Buy My Memories, subtitled The IRS Tapes, is instead one of the most interesting country albums of the year. Musicians have made records to pay off legal debts before. You may recall that Marvin Gaye conceived of his 1978 album Hear My Dear as an overdue alimony payment and turned in a bitter, sporadically brilliant, but compromised piece of work. As country music's most famous tax delinquent, Willie Nelson could have done the same thing. Recording only his voice and his acoustic guitar to keep down the overhead, he might have gone into the studio and just dashed off a piece of product. But no one who hears Pretend I Never Happened could believe that Nelson thinks of this project as mere product.
Pretend I never happened, and erase me from your mind. You will not want to remember any love as cold as mine. I'll be leaving in the morning for a place I hope I find. All the places must be better than the ones I leave behind.
This mood of baleful depression is sustained over the course of all 25 cuts on Who'll Buy My Memories. Listen to it all in one sitting, and the album might drive you to commit suicide a lot faster than anything by Judas Priest ever would.
You told me you'd love me forever, but the one in your arms is not me. So if this is what you refer to as love, then I'd rather you didn't love me.
As always, Nelson's straightforward songwriting is made more effective by his voice, a technically poor instrument that he uses with understated skill. The harsh tone, the way he speaks his lines as much as he croons them, the profound influence that jazz vocalizing has had on him, all of this combines to make Nelson an exceptional pop singer. It's ironic that his best recording in recent years should have been made under these circumstances, but I'm really glad he was prodded to make this record.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. The number for Willie Nelson's mail order album is 800-652-3400. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Some movies are so bad, they're entertaining. And, of course, part of the entertainment is the wisecracks you make as you watch. You get bad films with wisecracks on the cable comedy series Mystery Science Theater 3000. The premise is that a lab technician named Joel has been banished to outer space by bosses who don't like him. As punishment, the bosses force him to watch the worst movies ever made, mostly monster, science fiction, and teen exploitation films like Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster, The Slime People, and Daddy-O.
Well, our movie this week is called Project Moonbase, and it features a group of astronauts almost as inept as you are, Joel.
And a plot as weak as herbal tea.
Yes, but first, how about a double dip of our old friend Commando Cody and the radar men from the moon? Taste the pain, buddy.
Enjoy.
Whoa.
Joel and his robot friends survive their punishment by making constant wisecracks about the movie they've been condemned to watch. My guests are Joel Hodgson, the series creator and star, and Mike Nelson, the head writer. Mystery Science Theater 3000 is on the cable network Comedy Central, but Joel started the series as a local show on a Minneapolis TV station. Joel told me how he came up with the premise.
It's based on the premise that people naturally talk back to movies. And I knew a little bit about TV when we started, not very much, but I knew that it could be done fairly easily just putting the image in the bottom of the screen. And so that's kind of where it started, is I knew that it could be done, even though I had a real limited idea of how TV is really made.
When you say putting the image of the bottom of the screen, you mean the image of you and the robots who you're
right.
Wisecracking with.
It's a wildly low-tech show.
Yeah, really.
And so I kind of designed it that way so I would know what was going on.
Now, what about the part of the premise where you're being forced to watch bad movies in outer space as punishment?
Well, I designed that, I guess, so there would be some kind of... It would make more sense, because if they're really bad movies, which we acknowledge they are, why, and they were just people in a theater, why wouldn't the people get up and leave? So I kind of designed that prisoner aspect to as a rationale, I guess.
Now, Joel, before you started doing this TV program, did you enjoy seeking out bad movies so you can make fun of them?
Yeah, I think... you know, I guess there was a growing sensibility in the country, maybe in the 70s, that there's a lot of bad movies out there, and I think people started to make fun of them. They started to identify, this is a bad, low-budget movie, and it's okay to make fun of it.
Mike Nelson, you're the head writer for the show.
Right.
Did you used to intentionally seek out bad movies so you could ridicule them?
I had had a couple friends in college who, sure, we'd watch bad movies. A lot of references in the show to a movie called Mannequin, which was kind of one of my favorites to make fun of. But yeah, we used to rent, you know, Plan 9 and Robot Monster and do that kind of stuff.
I'll make a confession here. When I was in grade school, I used to have little Mitch Miller parties at home and invite people over just so we could make fun of Mitch Miller.
Wow.
Hey.
You invented Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, I thought I'd take credit for the whole thing.
You're hipper than us.
So how bad does a movie need to be before you'll show it? And are you ever surprised that a movie's actually better than you thought it would be and isn't going to work on the show?
Oh,
Mike?
We've never been surprised by a movie being too good. It may not fit our purposes. The other day we got a Jackie Chan movie. He's a martial arts, kind of a comic martial arts guy, and his movies are really quite funny. It might work, but we don't want to make fun of them because they're pretty good. But mostly the movies we get are almost too bad for our purposes. We get pretty down after seeing it the first time and just saying, there's no way we can do this. It's too bad.
What makes a movie too bad for you to even show to us?
Just terrible continuity, bad dubbing.
Ugly people doing ugly things to each other. That's
yeah,
a big problem.
Real mean. There's a lot of real mean-spirited movies out there that we've tried to do, and they really bring us down if they're real depraved. So we have to kind of, that can really get you down.
What was a movie that was too depraved for you?
What was that one we just saw?
Well, we did a movie called Side Hackers, which was a motorcycle film that We watched the first 10 minutes and thought it was pretty hysterical. And then we said yes to it, and we got it. And then upon watching it again, we realized there was a very ugly, violent crime that occurred about 11 minutes into it. And then we had to deal with that.
So we had to edit it out, and then we lost a lot of continuity in the film.
The film was just really, really ugly, and that was a really hard one.
Gee, I'd hate to think you guys were censoring the bad movies we were watching, editing out the scenes.
I bet you'd be happy we did.
You'd be pleased.
So yeah. What movie are you looking at now?
Teenage Caveman with Robert
Vaughn.
Robert Vaughn,
yeah. I've always wanted to see that.
It's really dull. Don't get too excited about it.
So you're working on Teenage Caveman now. What's the process like? What are you doing with it?
We wrote it for 2 days, just watched it and wrote down our comments. And then we added in comments that we have these home writers who do it at home and send in their scripts. And we process their comments into it. And then we go through it again and decide which are the best and kind of work that all out and assign the lines to the characters and whatnot.
So how many times have you seen the movie already?
4. And I'll see it 8 probably by the time it airs, maybe 10.
It's a lot of times to see a bad film.
Yeah, you get a certain kind of mental toughness about it.
You start to find amusement in the things that are not at all amusing.
So you watch a movie many times before you actually record the wisecracks. Joel, what's the recording process like?
Well, when we do the film, we're sitting in front of TV monitors in front of a big blue screen, and we have our scripts with time codes and the comments, and each character has an assigned comment. And we have maybe 700 remarks per film. And then we watch the movie and do our remarks and actions, you know, so the puppets' mouth movements are synced up and I'm moving the right way. So it is kind of like doing radio in a funny way because people are only seeing your shadow, you know.
Right, because you're silhouetted.
Yeah. I guess one of the nice things about writing it is that people get to say what we like to say because there's just so much room for jokes and 700 of them, so you can get in your little personal ball of pain, you know, every now and then.
I want to mention one of the comments that you made in one of the movies that I thought was really funny. This was, I think it was in Daddy-O, and there's this real, like, stocky cop type, and you say, oh, is he Charles Durning or Brian Dennehy? And I thought that was really funny because for reasons I can't figure out, I used to confuse the two all the time, maybe because they always played the same type. So I really, really got a kick out of that.
Yeah, that's we have kind of a list of those stocky character actors that we like to compare. M. Emmett Walsh kind of fits in on the fringes of that.
Right. And now a criticism. In Untamed Youth, which is this, you know, Mamie Van Doren teen exploitation film, the film also starred Eddie Cochran, who is probably best known for the 1958 hit Summertime Blues. So Mamie Van Doren and Eddie Cochran are prisoners doing time in a cotton field, picking cotton. And Eddie Cochran sings this really awful song called They Ain't Gonna Make a Cotton Picker Out of Me.
Right.
But then you say, they ain't gonna make a singer out of him either. This is like Up With People in prison. And I don't know, I was kind of annoyed that you didn't say something more knowing about Eddie Cochran and who he is. I mean, he wasn't just like any washed-up schmo singing that song. It was Eddie Cochran.
Yeah, to me it's like kind of the... that joke was driven by the sadness of guys getting cast in movies they shouldn't be in, you know.
In fact, you're not the first one to bring up the Eddie Cochran thing. There's been others.
Yeah.
Gorezone magazine was a little upset with us.
Who?
Gorezone magazine. It's one of those splatter effects magazine, and they were offended by everything we do, but especially that we talked over Eddie Cochran's song.
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to make in bringing this up is you're wondering, like, well, how much do these people know? Do you know what I mean? How much do they know about the actors, and how much do they care? And, like, do they love the movies as well as want to mock them? You know what I mean?
They know everything.
Yeah, no, we have the show has a definite personality, and it knows a lot about certain things, and it can be real ignorant about other things. And I think we knew about Eddie Cochran, but I'm not a fan, and so it's like that's going to show.
You know, Mystery Science Theater kind of plays on one of the nightmares I have. I don't know if you ever had this kind of nightmare, but you know, sometimes I think of myself talking on the radio, and I imagine groups of three or four people listening to the radio together, mocking every word that I say. It's like, you know, it's like your worst nightmare when you're on radio, and I imagine when you're on TV. So, so like, that's literally what you're doing. You're taking people's movies and, like, mocking every word that they say. Has that ever been a performer's nightmare of yours, that people are kind of doing that while you're performing?
Good question. I think there's a certain... We try to have a certain appropriateness to it. You know, people are at their homes watching TV, and they choose to watch our show or not. It's a lot different if someone's on stage and people are really being loud and distracting from the performer. I mean, we've all seen that, and that's not... I don't think we're really about that. I think it's a show based on that activity, but it's not that we condone that. So, yes, I think we talk about that a lot, how we live by the sword, we may die by the sword, and someday there'll be another, someone will buy our shows and put a second row of shadows and make fun of what we're saying. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Toodaloo.
Joel Hodgson and Mike Nelson of Mystery Science Theater 3000. The series is featured on the cable network Comedy Central. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have from the Soviet Union?
Quite a few things, Terry. We're trying to keep up with the latest news and sort news from rumors. There are persistent rumors that there is going to be some kind of a military move against the Russian Parliament building, where Boris Yeltsin is. We're consulting experts on whether or not this coup attempt will hold, and we're looking to ordinary people to see what their views of what is going on are, including a school teacher in Leningrad. We'll hear from President Bush, of course, and from other Western leaders, and talk about Gorbachev's gains and whether any of them are irreversible.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the last two decades, Chris Whittle has built a publishing empire. He's published Esquire magazine, a multitude of health magazines, and introduced a line of specialized videos for doctors' offices. Last year, he launched the controversial Channel One in high schools across the country. It's a 12-minute daily newscast of current events, sprinkled with 2 minutes of commercials. Maureen Corrigan sides with those who think high schools should remain a commercial-free zone. But on the other hand, she says ads are the most thought-provoking aspect of Whittle's latest project, a series of books called The Larger Agenda, about social topics.
With the fall college term approaching, it's time for me to meet with my feminist commando colleagues and plot the final overthrow of Western civilization. This year, we're going to rip Homer and Shakespeare to shreds. Paradise Lost? We'll turn copies of that patriarchal fairy tale into particle board. In its place, we'll teach seminars on Shirley MacLaine's autobiographical trilogy and the poetry of PMS. No one will ever dare mention that oppressive term, great books, again. Well, really, ever since Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, appeared in 1987, he and his conservative clones have been telling people that this is what feminists are doing to higher education. The mundane reality is that almost every English major is still required, for better or worse, to read Chaucer, Shakespeare, and Melville. But the fear of feminists and others who challenge the universality of the canon continues to spread. The latest doomsday dirge is James Atlas's hardbound essay, The Book Wars. Atlas is an editor of the New York Times Magazine, and this essay is an extended version of the interviews he's published with critics on both sides of the great books controversy, Bloom and E.D. Hirsch versus those smug academic outlaws at Duke who lecture on cowboy novels and the comics. The Book Wars helpfully summarizes the great books controversy, but here, Atlas doesn't have to maintain journalistic objectivity. after he waxes poetic for the second time about reading the classics as an undergraduate at Harvard, you know where he stands. By the end of the essay, Atlas endorses a great book's curriculum as our best defense against the forces of barbarism. Nothing new here. But what is startling about the book wars is its packaging. On every fourth page or so, there's a giant color ad for Federal Express. You see, the book wars is part of something called the Larger Agenda Series, a project launched by Whittle Publishing and backed by exclusive advertising from Federal Express. It's an aesthetic jolt to read a hardcover book that's packed with ads, but otherwise they don't bother me. Magazine fiction is surrounded by ads. Dickens' serialized masterpieces rubbed shoulders with illustrations of corsets and spittoons. In the book wars, however, the FedEx ads weirdly undermine the rarefied view of literature that Atlas champions. For instance, at one point, Atlas laments that books no longer possess the aura of sanctity they once did. But a photo of a sweating FedEx clerk on the next page reminds us that art has always been connected to the foul rag-and-bone shop of commerce. Conservative Roger Kimball charges that literature departments have become hostages to special interest groups, feminists, people of color, gays. But flip the page, and there's a picture of a FedEx driver delivering the message that this essay itself has been paid for by a special interest group. The Book Wars is a wacko entry into the great books controversy. On one side, you've got James Atlas and a bunch of conservative PhDs defending the transcendent value of the canon. On the other side, you've got a package delivery company demonstrating that literature has always been closely bound to the barbaric worlds of profit-making and politics. In my opinion, the Federal Express School of Literary Theory is the hands-down winner.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tuohy, and Robbie Harris. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, in the wake of the Soviet coup, former CIA head Stansfield Turner tells us what he thinks is going on in both the American and Soviet intelligence communities. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.